the committee physically and in virtual, to all our colleagues, public protector, your team led by Advocate Mbofu, the evidence leaders, Advocate let me pause there just for a while. Okay, it's back. Everybody else who's with us, members of the public listening and joining in the virtual as well as the media, welcome. This is our second day of the hearings. We wanted to start at 10, but we decided to wait for the changeover, so that we don't get destabilized. First power is supposed to come back at 10. Yesterday, I had indicated that we will finalize the issue of the directives. We'll defer that until the discussion on the expert witness today. We do operate in terms of our rules. So the absence of some of those specifics there, I will be applying that as a chair in the meantime. But for today, let me also take this opportunity and welcome as a first witness, Mr. Hassan Ibrahim, our expert witness, who's going to be taking the stand today. You're welcome, sir. We Enkosi Mkhulu, sesiqala. Ungayihoyi ke leya. Iyakuthanda ukwemba. Thank you. So I want us to get straight to the business of the day. And having welcomed you, Mr. Ibrahim, I'm supposed to just get, so it means I'll just have to wait for a few minutes because I need to get our legal advisor, Fatima Ibrahim, to be leading and taking the witness through the processes. And she'll be doing that from the virtual. So we'll just be patient for a few minutes, colleagues, if that's not a problem with you, so that we start properly. Thank you. Malam kolo. Thank you. We seem to be back. Fatima, can you hear us?
Yes, Chair, I can hear you clearly.
Thank you. I want to recognize you to lead the witness.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Mr. Ibrahim. Chair, as far as I know, myself and Mr. Ibrahim are not related, but if I could please ask him to give us his full name for the record.
Just switch off Baunyonzo Leyako and Advocate Bauer so that we don't have petition. The only mics that are going to be on Ileyam Naleka, Mr. Ibrahim, depend up. Not that.
Good morning, Chairperson. Yes, the name is Hassan Ibrahim.
Thank you, Mr. Ibrahim. So you have been invited, subject to the provisions of Section 16 of the Power, Privileges and Immunities of Parliament and Provincial Legislatures Act 2004, to appear before this committee as a witness and to answer questions in respect of the Section 194 Committee's inquiry into the removal of the Public Protector Advocate Mukwabani. Please be informed that by law you are required to answer fully and satisfactorily all the questions lawfully put to you, or to produce any document that you are required to produce in connection with the subject matter of the inquiry, notwithstanding the fact that the answer or document could incriminate you or expose you to criminal or civil proceedings or damages. You are, however, protected in that evidence given under oath or affirmation before a House or committee may not be used against you in any court or place outside Parliament, except in criminal proceedings concerning a charge of perjury or a charge relating to the evidence or documents required in these proceedings. Please be aware further that in terms of Section 17(2) of the Powers Act, a person who willfully furnishes a House or committee with information or makes a statement before it which is false or misleading commits an offence and is liable to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 2 years. So you will now be required to take an oath or affirmation that the evidence you are about to give is truthful. You may choose to take either. Can I please have your preference whether you'd like to take the oath or affirmation?
No objection. Thank you. I'm happy to do so. I'm happy to take the oath.
Thank you. If I can ask you to please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I swear that the evidence I shall give.
I submit that the evidence I shall give
shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but truth.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Thank you, Chair. The witness is now duly sworn in.
Thank you very much, Fatima Ibrahim, Imam Kulu. You will be, Mr. Abrams, you can maybe even switch both those mics or whichever that's closer to you, because I would also like you to raise your voice so that we can hear you properly.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Thank you. Now that you have done that important exercise, I want to invite you to take.
Good morning, Mr. Ibrahim.
Good morning,
Mr. Ibrahim. You deposed to an affidavit in this matter, correct?
That's correct. Yes.
And attached to the affidavit is a report, which sets out the legal framework of the public protector.
That's correct.
And you did this after you were approached by ourselves as evident leaders, where we requested your assistance in relation to contextualizing the public protector within the constitutional and legislative framework of South Africa.
That is correct, yes.
Could you tell the committee a little bit about your experience and how you came to be one of the people that could be approached to talk about the public protector, and a little bit about your qualifications as well?
Thank you very much, Chip. My background is fairly basic. I took a degree in law at the University of Botswana and Universities of Edinburgh. And immediately after 1990, I joined the negotiations process in the World Trade Center at CODESA, supported the processes in CODESA and the multi-party negotiations process. In 1994, I was elected to the Gauteng Parliament. Immediately after that, when the Constitutional Assembly was established in 1994, I got involved in the Constitutional Assembly process, heading the administration as the executive director. I completed the process in the Constitutional Assembly, and after that worked in the Department of Justice for 10 years, implementing the Constitution. And thereafter, after a few stints in the public sector, I started working internationally in a number of assignments, mainly for the United Nations, in different constitution-making processes throughout the world, particularly in developing countries. So that's how, my background and how I come to have some knowledge about the constitution and the process itself.
Thank you, Mr. Ibrahim. So the report, as discussed between myself and you yesterday, you're going to take us through the report, and I will direct you whether there's any aspects that I think we would need further clarification or emphasis or particular aspects that the members in the discussions that ensued yesterday may be particularly interested in.
Recording in progress.
Rather than me asking you a specific question and we go through the task of you having to answer each one. So if I could leave it for you to start taking us through the report, and if you don't mind, I'll interrupt you as and when it's required.
That's perfect.
And maybe to start off by saying that in the first section of your report, you very helpfully set out the founding values and constitutional principles, and maybe start at that aspect and how the protections for the public protector comes about.
Chairperson, thank you. That's very helpful. Thank you very much. If I may just say, the structure of the report, thought it best to have it highlighted with clear headings and subheadings, which would help us in starting from the general, being the founding values and the constitutional principles, then focusing on the Chapter 9 institutions, and then moving on to the specifics of the Office of the Public Protector, thereafter the appointment of the Public Protector, standards of conduct, and dealing with the personnel in the office, and then the removal and conclusions. So you'll find that the report is structured in a way in which it will provide some sort of a checklist, hopefully that will be of benefit and value to the committee in applying its mind to whatever its discussions may lead it to. Chairperson, if I may start off, I think the proper starting point really would be the founding values. And of course, we talk about the supremacy of the Constitution, the rule of law, and the fact that we have a democratic government that is focused on ensuring accountability, responsiveness, and openness. And of course, the foundational is separation of powers. Now, I had occasion to look at the submissions made by all the political parties in the process of the constitution making exercise. And unpacking separation of powers, what comes across through all the political parties is the issue of checks and balances, the importance of emphasizing that there be appropriate checks and balances. And I'll come back to that. Now, what is critical in our constitution is that the public protector is defined as an organ of state, as contemplated in Section 239. But the important parts of it is that all organs to do the usual, which would be loyal to the Constitution and the Republic and its people, But very importantly, in this particular instance and the discussion on the hand, is to have respect to the constitutional status, institutions, power and functions of government in other spheres. Of course, also further is that not to assume any powers or functions except those conferred on it on them by the Constitution. Then to exercise their powers and functions in a manner that does not encroach on the geographical, functional, or institutional integrity of government in other spheres. Now, in Section 195 of the Constitution, which sets out really what are the basic values of structures in public administration, of which the public protector is one, it identifies, and I want to specifically home in on the first two, which is all of these institutions which are affected and required to apply the basic values and principles of public administration require a high standard of professional ethics that must be promoted and maintained. And secondly, that they must do so in a manner that will be efficient and economic effective use of the resources that must be ensured. If I move on, the constitutional principles are fairly important, and these constitutional principles come out of the two certification exercises once the constitution was concluded. And it is noteworthy that the first certification judgment rejected the constitution for compliance, for non-compliance with the constitutional principles, the 34 constitutional principles, in particular, principle 29, which requires that the independence and impartiality of the public protector must be provided for and safeguarded by the Constitution in the interests of maintenance of effective public finance and administration and a high standard of professional ethics. The important part of it was that the court complained of the fact that the public protector was not granted sufficient enough protection under the Constitution and therefore rejected it, which meant that the Constitution came back to us in the Constitutional Assembly. We had to reconvene the theme committees and review it. And lo and behold, we corrected that. And at the second constitutional, the second certification exercise, the Constitutional Court approved the compliance with the constitutional principles. Now, very important in that was that the court noted, the Constitutional Court noted that independence and impartiality of the public protector will be vital to ensuring effective, accountable, and responsible government, and that the office inherently entails investigation of sensitive potential potentially embarrassing affairs of government, which is why the public protector deserved protection. And that protection meant that the public protector could not be removed from office based on a simple resolution of a simple majority. It needed a higher majority. And so when it came back to the Constitutional Assembly, we agreed to after reconvening the theme committees, the Constitutional Assembly took a decision. And with regard to the 2 points, firstly, that the public protector will be appointed with the support of at least 60% so as to ensure a supermajority, as well as the removal by a supporting vote of at least 2/3 of the National Assembly. And that's critical. So those are the broad constitutional framework within which the office of the public protector must be understood and located. Now, Chairperson, I just want to make some comments. The South African Constitution is very different to all the previous constitutions that were drafted. It set a best practice. And the best practice it set was defined by three major areas. Firstly, the Bill of Rights, which included socio-economic rights. Secondly, the chapter on cooperative governance, which is unheard of and unseen in other comparative constitutions. And thirdly, very importantly, it's a chapter 9 institutions. No other constitution previously had a chapter which required support of constitutional democracy. Now, what happened in constitutions until our constitution got adopted was that constitutions were regarded merely as rules of government. Rather, what our constitution did, which was novel, it started looking at constitutional democracy as something that is alive rather than static rules. So it brought the process of governance alive, and very important in bringing that alive was the three aspects, the Bill of Rights, specifically socioeconomic rights, cooperative governance, which required that interaction, as well as Chapter 9 institutions. Now, what happened effectively is that the South African Constitution redefined the way in which we look at constitutional democracy internationally. That has a major implication for us, because it also means that when we look at understanding the institutions, we do not look at international jurisprudence or international best practice, because we are the best practice. And that is of critical importance. It also signifies that the constitution itself is really alive. And this is brought clear in the statement where the Constitutional Court says very clearly that the public protector is required to play an oversight role over government to enhance and accountability and to contribute to the constitutional project of transformation. Now, that's really critical. That comes from one of the cases. Now, each of the institutions in Chapter 9 is guaranteed to be independent. It is required to be impartial and fundamentally must be assisted and protected by all the other organs of state. At a later point, I would unpack the concept of independence a little further and say to say that the last point that is of critical importance is that the public protector and all other Chapter 9 institutions are accountable to the National Assembly, which means that the National Assembly has a full authority oversight over these Chapter 9 institutions. However, what is really important is that there are four critical values that come throughout in all the discussions and jurisprudence on Chapter 9 institutions. And the four critical values would be independence, impartiality, dignity, and effectiveness. Those are critical and resonate throughout. And in the second certification, it was said that these institutions perform sensitive functions which require their independence and impartiality to be beyond question and to be protected by stringent provisions in the Constitution. Jefferson, if I may move over now, focus on the office of the public protector itself. Historically, the concept originated with the concept of an ombud rather than a public protector. And it was the Swedish parliament that established the idea of ombud in 1809. However, if you look at a very useful article here is the Dlamini article, because it will set out the history around the South African approach to the public protector. And very clearly, it was only in 1979 that the Advocate General, or the South African version of the ombud, was established. And this took place after the Info scandal, and government felt it was important to have a body like that. But this body, called the Advocate General, was limited to purely financial conduct. Financial misconduct and dealing with public money in a dishonest manner. So it's only in 1979 that in South African jurisprudence and concepts, you find the idea of an ombud coming through or in the form of the Advocate General. So it was in 1991 that the Advocate General was then replaced to the office of the ombud. It's very interesting to see in the submissions that came through to the Constitutional Assembly, what the last ombudsman before the public protector was established said about the establishment of the the Public Protector's Office, and I'll touch on it just a little later. Now, the establishment of the office was an important aspect of our history and the advent of in the advent of democracy. In the first certification judgment, the Constitutional Court explained that the purpose of the office of the Public Protector is to ensure that there is an effective public service which maintains a high standard of professional ethics, which in itself was a major departure from previous concepts of an ombud, which signifies that what we have in the Public Protector is not what the rest of the world had in the ombud. It was a totally different institution because it was alive. What we will see throughout this discussion is that the Public Protector is one of the most important constitutional citizens as such, with an extremely high status, with a great responsibility, and also generates a great deal of expectation. And the rest of my this input would dwell on that in more greater detail. Now, let me go to the functions of the office itself, because it really helps distinguish it from the ordinary ombud. The first and a very important function in terms of Section 182 of the Constitution is that the Public Protector is required to investigate any conduct in state affairs or in public administration in any sphere of government that is alleged or suspected to be improper, which means that it could be either on the basis of a complaint or on the basis of own initiative. The Public Protector would be allowed to investigate conduct. Secondly, and this is the only part which is a duplicate of the old concept of an ombud, is to report on that conduct. But thirdly, the Public Protector is required to take appropriate remedial action, which is unheard of. And so it's quite a novel constitutional concept and very important power that is provided for. However, although the Public Protector has further powers which will be set out in the legislation added to what is in the Constitution, there are only two limitations to the Public Protector. And the first is that the Public Protector is precluded from investigating court decisions. It's not possible. The second is, really relates to the time period. The Public Protector is also precluded from investigating matters beyond 2 years unless it's under very specific conditions. So those are the only two limitations that are imposed. There's an added point, which is that, and it's fundamental to the conceptualization of the Public Protector, is that the Public Protector must be accessible to all persons and communities in the country. And that accessibility really has manifested itself specifically in the form of outreach and the way in which a Public Protector had considered outreach and reaching out, making itself and its institutions or support and services accessible to the broad public. The second, besides the Dlamini article, there's also the work that has been put together by Bishop and Woolman. And there's a very interesting and useful quotation from Bishop and Woolman, which I think to be of value to this committee. And if you'll allow me, I just to read very briefly. It says that the Public Protector's purpose is profitably compared with the role of the judiciary. Now, whereas courts handle really matters and disputes that deal with conduct and law, and they rely on really correct procedure, the Public Protector is very different because it will focus on broader issues of simple misunderstandings or bureaucratic red tape, and nor do they lend themselves to the resolution on injustice that turn on unfairness and illegality. So the Public Protector deals with more than just law and conduct and based on basic procedure, but goes much beyond. The Public Protector therefore requires or occupies a middle space. It serves the public and assists the courts and the legislature. And this is fundamental. because it does help the courts and both the courts and the legislature. It helps the courts because it deals with administration of justice matters which fall outside of the ambit of a court, well beyond, and the courts cannot deal with these issues. That's what the public protector deals with. But fundamentally, and to Parliament, the public protector helps by monitoring the performance of the executive in a whole host of ways and answering those complaints which otherwise elected representatives are not able to address effectively. And so the public protector fulfills an incredibly important role. Let me move on to the competencies of this office. Now, the first bit is that under Section 4 of the Public Protector Act, which comes from based on Section 182 of the Constitution, it states that the public protector shall be competent, firstly, to investigate on his or her own initiative or on receipt of a complaint, which means through monitoring and outreach, all complaints received, it will investigate any alleged maladministration, abuse or unjustified exercise of power or unfair, capricious, discourteous or other improper conduct or undue delay by a person performing a public function. So it's very, very broad. Improper and dishonest act or omission or offences, improper or unlawful enrichment, and also it will investigate acts or omissions by a person in the employ of government, which may result in unlawful or improper prejudice to any other person. So it's an extremely wide set of powers. But in addition, the public protector is competent to endeavor in his or her own sole discretion to resolve any dispute. And this is where the powers are so wide, because it goes well beyond that of an ombud, because it has a power to resolve matters by mediation, conciliation, or negotiation, unheard of before and certainly novel in our own institution. Also, to advise where necessary any complainant regarding appropriate remedies. So if there's a criminal offense or any other matter, the public protector would advise that such person to seek other possible remedies or opportunities. Very importantly, also, it would offer, the public protector has the ability, power to pursue mediation or negotiation, advising the complainant of any further remedies that are available, and or reporting a criminal offense to the authorities, to report the matter to another public authority, and to resolve the issue through any other means that may be expedient in the circumstance. In effect, the public protector becomes a problem solver, not just providing a report or taking remedial action. It goes beyond trying to find solutions to the issues. Very importantly, the public protector has further powers, not just with regard to institutions of state, but particularly also public entities and state-owned corporations. So it goes beyond. So it incorporates, and that's where all of the recent state capture reports and all the other reports and investigations were conducted. So as such, the public protector is bestowed with really extensive powers of oversight. Now, in previous constitutions, that oversight was really between the three branches of government. For the first time, you now had Chapter 9 institutions, particularly the public protector, which has this power, extensive power of oversight. I just wanted to touch on the issue of the limitation of the public protector with regard to the two-year limit, because it's important that with all the powers that it has, the public protector can only investigate matters within 2 years from the occurrence of the incident or the matter concerned. And this was dealt with in a number of court matters. And so the High Court found that if a matter is to be accepted outside of the two-year period, the public protector must identify special circumstances justifying the consideration of matters that are more than 2 years.
In fact, Mr. Ibrahim, if I can interrupt you there, that's the wording of Section 6.9 of the Public Protectors Act that sets that limitation to it.
That's correct, yes. Thank you very much. And according to the High Court again, it's very clear that a public protector cannot have matters introduced ex post facto by third parties relating to a matter that has extended for more than 2 years. And very importantly, you know, for example, the public protector cannot cite persistent prejudice to a complaint or Section 195 of the Constitution to justify investigating conduct that occurred more than 2 years earlier. So that's very important. So the Office of the Public Protector offers aggrieved members of the public a mechanism through which to address their complaints about the exercise of public power. The requirements for reporting a complaint to the public protector in terms of the Act is fairly undemanding. And very important part of it is that the public protector's personnel are obliged, in terms of the Act, to render necessary assistance free of charge to enable any person complying with the reporting requirements, which means that the public protector is required to make itself accessible and help any member of the public that wishes to bring about a matter. At the same time, Chairperson, the office is also markedly different from courts. It does not follow formal procedure. There's no formal procedure that binds the public protector and its personnel. They are obliged to assist aggrieved persons to report their complaints, and it's concerned with impropriety and prejudice rather than limited to questions of lawfulness. And it is aimed at being far more accessible to ordinary citizens. So in the submissions made by the last ombud to the Constitutional Assembly, this is a point that the ombud raised specifically, that the drafting suggested that it would deal with impropriety and prejudice, which was much broader than they were used to, suggesting that the public protector went well beyond what was previously considered necessary. Chairperson, I want to go on to the core principles. And one of the early cases was the SABC case, which helped us in identifying some of the core principles. There's a wonderful quotation from the court which says that the office serves to watch the watchers and to guarantee that government discharges its responsibility without fear or favor or prejudice. And that's very critical because it helps a great deal. And effectively, what the court said is that it will be the last defense against bureaucratic oppression, corruption, and malfeasance in public office, which is fairly crisp and very precise. Also, the public protector is not subject to the national executive control and is independent from the national sphere of government. The office is really effectively outside of government, which means
Mr. Nodad, that traffic is not helpful. Go ahead, Mr. Hassan.
Chairperson, what is really important is that the definition of the public protector being outside of government. Very critically, the public protector cannot be seen to be either for or against government. It's really independent. It has an independent authority and basis and foundation in the Constitution itself. Now, In my home, I have my many children and grandchildren. They talk a lot about superheroes. Maybe constitutionally, public protector is one of those superheroes, really. And I'll talk a little bit about it because it's.
You mean the office or the person?
Sorry?
You mean the office or the person? Office. Oh, okay.
The public protector has a wide and a vast array of measures available to the public protector to take remedial action in response to maladministration and corruption. Essentially, my children and grandchildren grew up with this idea of superheroes being able to solve all problems and deal with all sorts of difficulties and so on. And this is what really comes about. The public protector occupies a unique position in our constitutional order. And that's really very important because the office is neither a court nor an administrative decision maker. The public protector cannot realize the constitutional purpose of office if other organs of state may second guess her findings and ignore her recommendations. Accordingly, the protector may determine an effective remedy for state misconduct, direct its implementations, the findings, decisions, and remedial action of the public protector may not be ignored and must, if they are disputed, be challenged through judicial review. So otherwise, it is peremptory. It is necessary that people comply with the remedial orders issued by the public protector. So we have the very interesting case, a very important case of the economic freedom fighters, which I refer to as a 2016 case. Where
and maybe, Mr. Ibrahim, yeah. if we can just pause there. Although in your report it's referred to as the 2016 case, it's the same case which my friend Advocate Mpofu referred to yesterday as the EFF case.
That's correct. So the Constitutional Court reached very important conclusions in that case. It said that the public protector is pivotal to the facilitation of good governance in our constitutional dispensation, such that the Constitution guarantees and four concepts that come throughout the discussion: independence, impartiality, dignity, and effectiveness of the institution. So those are four important concepts that are of critical importance. Jefferson, I just go on to the idea that the name of the office was carefully selected. In fact, it was a very inspired decision. And I remember very clearly how that came about and the discussion and debate in the Constitutional Assembly, whether we were talking of an ombud or not an ombud. And people felt that we should be talking about a protector of the public. And primarily because most of the constitutional makers at that time had experiences which suggested that one had to be cautious about the administration of government. And part of that required a public protector to protect people who were maybe aggrieved of any service that may be inappropriate and from which public needed protection. And therefore, the concept of a public protector came about. And it really inspired the world. And throughout the world, wherever I travel, most of my colleagues are inspired by this concept, and it's taken, it's resonated with a number of jurisdictions where people have replicated this concept in their own constitution-making processes. So the Office of the Public Protector has wide and constitutionally crucial powers. And again, in that case, there's a wonderful quotation which says that the Public Protector is thus one of the most invaluable constitutional gifts to our nation in the fight against corruption, unlawful enrichment, prejudice, and impropriety in state affairs, and for the betterment of good governance. Now, further on in that quotation, it says that the constitution makers, or the fathers and mothers of the constitution, conceived of a way to give even the poor and marginalized a voice and teeth that could bite corruption and abuse excruciatingly. And further on in the quotation, it also says, our constitutional democracy can only be truly strengthened when There is zero tolerance for the culture of impunity. Now, in order for the public protector to be effective, complying with the remedial action ordered cannot be optional. And therefore, the only alternative to a remediate or grievance against a remedial action ordered is judicial review. So it would be at odds with the rule of law for the subject of an investigation to determine whether to comply with public protector's report or not. It's really obligatory. It's binding. It's framed in a peremptory manner that must be implemented as directed. The public protector's powers are essential components of the constitutional architecture designed to give effect to the Constitution's founding values. But very important here, Chairperson, is that with this great power, as you will see later in the discussion, there's also great responsibilities and expectations. Now, moreover, it is essential that the public whom the office is meant to serve respects the office of the public protector, and that the public protector is in every way above reproach. And so what happens is that as a constitutional citizen, the public protector is elevated to an extremely high level, given great powers. But with this, there's great responsibility. And one of the fundamental responsibilities is that the public protector is required to inspire confidence in the way in which it carries out in its conduct and its activities. I proceed now, Chairperson, to deal with appointment of the public protector. And the first point I want to deal with is the higher threshold. The public protector is appointed by the President on the recommendation of the National Assembly for one renewable term of 7 years. And the recommendation of the National Assembly must be supported by at least 60%, which means that there's a majority. It's not just a simple majority. And so the appointment of the public protector is also materially different from the appointment of judicial officers, which is quite critical. I go on now to the requirements for the appointment of the public protector. And very important in the requirements of the public protector is a term that is used generally in constitutions, both in ours and others, the concept of a fit and proper person to hold that particular office. And that deserves some understanding, because the Constitution itself doesn't define what fit and proper really means. Except that in what happened in the Reserve Bank case is that it merely stated that the office requires high standards and very general. Now, Section 1 of the Public Protector Act stipulates more detailed requirements that an individual must meet in order to be eligible for the office. Fundamentally, from the experience of either a judge or an admitted advocate or attorney, somebody who is qualified and has significant legal experience, a common thread is that there must be 10 years of experience in the legal field, requiring a person who is to be appointed as a public protector to have significant legal experience and expertise in the area of law or public administration. Furthermore, the constitutional and statutory requirements obviously suggest that the incumbent must be somebody who is beyond reproach and a person of stature and suitably qualified. And this is what we can gather from the requirements that are set out. Chairperson, I want to go on to more detail on the objective of the concept of fit and proper, because what happened in our jurisprudence and discussion is that it's not just basically a fit and proper person, as in an attorney or advocate that is appointed to the bar. in the instance of the public protector, there's an objectively fit and proper concept that comes through. Now, this came through in the NDPP case. The Constitutional Court was concerned with whether a particular individual was appropriately qualified for the office of the NDPP. And therefore, they had to look at really the concept of what was required by fit and proper and as required by the legislation. And what is clear is that although the president appoints the NDPP, the constitution requires that parliament to determine the details of the NDPP's qualifications. In order for both to discharge their respective functions and prescribe qualifications must be objective, which means that it cannot be simply in the president's view that the person is fit and proper. It must be supported by parliament, and instead it stipulates that the NDPP must be fit and proper in a broader sense, and it must be an objective requirement rather than a subjective understanding. And very importantly, is that, you know, if a new president was to assume office, they could not come to a different view. It had to be an objective standard. Now, as is evident from the legislation, the purpose of the president's power to appoint the NDPP is to ensure that the incumbent, and this is what is very important, is sufficiently conscientious and thus and has the integrity required to be entrusted with the responsibilities of the office. And that's a very useful way in which to view this. Now, any evidence regarding the incumbent's credibility, honesty, and integrity and conscientiousness would be relevant and material to the exercise of this power. And fundamentally, what is very clear is that dishonesty is dishonesty. So if it impacts, if it's dishonesty, wherever it is, wherever it occurs, it's fundamental and it's fatal. It'll impact on the credibility, honesty, integrity, and conscientiousness. So dishonesty is of a critical or fatal nature. Let me deal with the characteristics of fit and proper, because we aided and assisted by a whole host of jurisprudence that helps us identify.
Mr. Ibrahim, sorry to interrupt you. Before you get there, you've skipped through 48.4, which was a conclusion you reached just simply applying the same principles in the NDPP case to the office of the public protector.
Absolutely. The case law in this particular case, the NDPP case, in which court had to apply its mind to what is fit and proper, clearly applies also to the public protector chairperson. Thank you very much for that. Yes. Let me deal with the characteristics of fit and what is fit and proper. It's basically a threshold requirement for anyone requiring admission as the legal practitioner. Now, jurisprudence establishes the following. Firstly, it's an objective finding of fact. The requirement that the practitioner be fit and proper is closely linked to the overarching need to protect the public by ensuring that it is not exposed to a person who should not be in practice. And that's very important. Secondly, one requirement of fitness and propriety for the legal practitioner is that of absolute honesty. Even dishonesty outside the courtroom or in respect of a relatively trifling matter can render an individual unfit and improper. So any form of dishonesty under oath can render an individual unfit and improper. Fitness and propriety, therefore, demands absolute integrity and scrupulous honesty. I'll touch on that a little later as well and unpack that further, the question of honesty and integrity. The other requirement is that of reliability and utmost good faith in dealing with courts. And if I may quote the judgment, the Swain case, It says very clearly, the profession of advocate and attorney require the utmost good faith from all practitioners and aspirant practitioners. In my opinion, the applicant's failure to disclose material facts in the circumstances of the present case was a failure to show good faith, such good faith. And the court goes on in describing further what good faith means and so on. Now, practitioners must not be allowed to exploit loopholes to suit their own interests or to show disregard for the law. And that's fundamental, which is why advocates are subject to this overarching duty not to mislead. They must not misstate facts or knowingly conceal the truth or make charges without supporting evidence. They must disclose all the relevant legal authority, even those that are against them, and must disclose relevant documents and evidence. So there must be total disclosure, and a judge is entitled to take counsel at their word. If they say, if counsel says, this is the law on the matter, a judge should be allowed to accept it as a full truth without wondering whether there were cases that were contradictory the argument. Now, practitioners also have a duty to remain abreast of the law and legal developments and to ensure that legal submissions are accurate. So care must be taken that this does not occur through ignorance or negligence. And when an argument is advanced and authority is cited, there's tacit representation by counsel that no contradictory authority is known to them. And this came very clear in one of the cases as well. So it's very important the obligation that is placed on a counsel before court. The norms regarding fitness and propriety for legal practitioners are a useful guide in determining, at the minimum, what renders an individual fit and proper for the office of the public protector, particularly given the similarities between the activities they are required to conduct. In this regard, a fit and proper individual must demonstrate absolute personal integrity, scrupulous honesty, must always be reliable, and show good faith, must demonstrate proper knowledge of and regard for the law, must not misstate facts, conceal the truth, or make unsubstantiated allegations, and must disclose all the relevant evidence in the appropriate form. So it's a very onerous responsibility and obligation, and it's very clear that responsibility and obligation would not only apply to a legal professional appearing in court, but also to the public protector itself. However, there are general standards for fitness and propriety for legal practitioners are really lower than the standards required to be observed of senior constitutional office bearers. And this is a fundamental point because the Constitution establishes a number of constitutional office bearers, and the public protector is one of them. And those requirements are much more onerous than that of an ordinary legal officer appearing before court. So constitutional office bearers may be removed for conduct such as legal incompetence, even if the legal incompetence would not be sufficient to render an individual unfit or improper to practice as an attorney or an advocate. So it's very important that there's a higher standard that is really required. And again, and that chairperson comes from the fairly interesting case, the Jiba case, which helps explain this constitution, the concept of a constitutional office and the requirements of a constitutional office bearer. Given the public protector's high constitutional status and the role in ensuring clean and honest government, the principles must apply with even greater intensity to any incumbent who should ensure throughout the tenure and at all material times that the public protector, and I want to go through the details very clearly, so at the very least must meet constitutional requirements of being fit and proper as an objective requirement. Fitness and propriety must determine the basis on the required institutional competency, as well as the constitutional obligations that the individual will be required to discharge. Chairperson, I just want to highlight the two concepts that come through here because it's repeated elsewhere, is a concept of institutional competence and constitutional obligations. Those come through and resonate further on in the discussions as well, and we'll touch on them again. So the public protector must be beyond reproach, a person of stature and suitably qualified, acting with dedication and capable of maintaining high standards, is sufficiently conscientious and has the integrity to require them to be entrusted with the responsibilities of the office of the public protector and to discharge the substantial constitutional duties or obligations. Must exercise powers and functions with actual and demonstrable independence, impartiality, dignity, and effectiveness, as well as the ability to discharge sensitive functions, irrespective of whether or not it may be and may antagonize any powerful or otherwise functionaries, and do so without any indications of dishonesty, incompetence, and partiality, of all of which are incompatible with an office that is aimed at ensuring clean and accountable governance. Must hence discharge all responsibilities honestly, independently, and ensure a fair administration of the office of the public protector and in the work done by the office of the public protector. Must maintain credibility, scrupulous honesty, personal integrity, and conscientious. Again, those four or five concepts that come through repeatedly. Must maintain reliability and utmost good faith in all dealings as public protector, including in its dealings with courts. But in every other aspect, openness and transparency should permeate the workings of this office and save in very exceptional circumstances through its office, through its work, and even in any litigious matter, must at all times act in utmost good faith and be scrupulous in all its dealings, be it in relation to complaints, the subject matter of the complaint, or persons implicated in investigations and to court. In relation to the latter, the same scrutiny facing practitioners when in court of law should lie with the public protector, especially where such bears the mantle of being a qualified legal practitioner, and must remain abreast of the law and legal developments and ensure that the application of the law is accurate and neither ignorance nor negligence should permeate the work of the public protector. The chairperson, at all times, a public protector must not put personal interests over and above public interests, and not put personal interests above those of the office of the public protector. Those are fairly important concepts and the mandates of such office. If I may move on to the standards of conduct. Very importantly in the standards of conduct is firstly dealing with investigations. Now, through the legislation and the various jurisprudence, the type of investigations, the way in which the conduct of investigations have been clearly defined. And so it's important to set this out because the standards of conduct must be clearly set out. Now, albeit in a somewhat different context, the Constitutional Court said the following about determining the proper standard of conduct for a public office bearer. So it applies to all public office bearers, and this is a conduct that is required. The question of what would constitute improper conduct can be answered with the reference to two linked issues. Again, institutional competence and constitutional obligations are repeated again. From an institutional perspective, public officials occupying certain positions would be expected to act in a certain manner because of the expertise and dedication to that position. So the public protector may conduct an investigation on own initiative based on complaints or information that come to the public protector's attention. But very importantly, the public protector may determine the format and the procedure for that investigation. So unlike a court, the public protector can decide how the public protector wishes to carry out an investigation, not obliged to adhere to specific procedure. The investigation must be conducted without fear of favor or prejudice to the complainants and need to be dealt with in a manner that enhances dignity and with respect to their complaints of whatever nature. Secondly, documentary and evidentiary records are subject to a general rule of non-disclosure. And that's fundamental because it also impacts on fair procedure and may not be disclosed to any other person during the course of an investigation unless the public protector determines otherwise. The next point is also important because it's quite critical in this discussion. The public protector must be active when conducting an investigation. She is not entitled to be passive, supine, and static in her approach, nor can she fail to address complaints or allegations without good cause or narrow the scope of investigations to the point that they do not meaningfully address the allegations and prima facie evidence of misconduct and impropriety in office. Essentially, my approach to this particular important point is that one follows the money. You look at where the budget is applied. And if you follow the money, you'd be able to see to what extent the public protector has been active when conducting investigations and what that activity has been. Furthermore, when the public protector receives complaints of impropriety or abuse of office, she's obliged to use the powers vested in her to ensure that the complaint is properly and effectively addressed. When an investigation is required, it should be conducted as comprehensively as possible in order to inspire, and these are the important words, the manner in which an investigation is conducted must inspire public confidence that the truth has been discovered, that the reports are accurate, meaningful, and reliable, and that the remedial action that she takes is appropriate. So this is the concept that comes or emanates from the Constitution itself, which says that the public protector is one of those institutions that strengthens constitutional democracy. It's a very active role that is required. Chairperson, I proceed to procedural fairness.
Mr. Ibrahim, just before you get to procedural fairness, in the section that deals with investigations and the manner in which those investigations are to be conducted, those are articulated in Section 7 of the Public Protector Act, correct?
That's correct. Right. Yes, that is correct. Chairperson, to deal with procedural fairness, and this is important. The public protector is subject to a statutory duty to observe procedural fairness, in that if it appears that any person may be adversely affected or detrimentally implicated by finding, that person must be afforded an opportunity to respond. Chairperson, this is fundamental in fairness and in all administration of justice matters. So it's a basic aspect of the way in which procedures are undertaken. So whilst the public protector is not obliged to have formal procedures like a court, its procedures has to be fair. So this duty is really entrenched in Section 7(9) of the Public Protector Act, which provides as follows. If it appears to the public protector during the course of an investigation that any person is being implicated in the matter being investigated, and that such implications may be to the detriment of the person, or that an adverse finding pertaining to that person may result, the public protector shall afford such person an opportunity to respond in connection therewith. And that's really what the law states. It's fairly basic. It's a basic injunction. And furthermore, that such person shall be afforded an opportunity to be heard in connection therewith by way of giving evidence. So any person that is implicated should be afforded that opportunity. Furthermore, in the case, Chairperson, of public protector versus the president, the majority judgment of the Constitutional Court is pretty instructive. And forgive me for reading through it, but it's fairly important that one goes through the matters and lists them because it's fairly direct. When an individual is implicated during the course of an investigation, the public protector is obliged to afford such a person an opportunity to respond to the implicating evidence. If the implication may be detrimental to that person, or if a finding adverse to him or her is anticipated, the form or the manner of the response depends on the circumstances of each case. For example, if the implication was made in a sworn statement, a response in a sworn statement would suffice. Where the implication was made in an oral testimony, the implicated person would be entitled to adduce controverting evidence before the public protector. In addition, that person has a right to question the witness who gave the relevant testimony. This questioning must be done through the public protector. Implicit in this process is that the affected person would be afforded an opportunity to make representations on the relevant evidence. Ordinarily, the questions should be put to the witness in the presence of the affected person or her legal representatives. The judgment goes on to say it cannot be gainsaid that a public protector's investigation may implicate the rights in the Bill of Rights. Consequently, the public protector act in terms of which the investigations are undertaken must be interpreted in a manner which were reasonably possible that promotes the objects of the Bill of Rights. Section 979, subsection 9, declares that if it appears to the public protector at any time during the course of an investigation that an adverse finding or a detrimental implication may result, the public protector must afford the affected person a hearing. Implicit in the language of Section 79 is that where it appears that a particular remedial action adverse to the affected person may be taken, the public protector should afford that person an opportunity to make representation on the contemplated remedial action. If the section were to be read otherwise, the procedural fairness it guarantees would be seriously undermined. There is no reason in principle or logic that fairness envisaged in the provision should be restricted to findings or implication by evidence. The bigger risk to the affected person's rights is posed by the remedial action. And Section 79 should not be given a meaning that is antithetical to the rule of law. For all these reasons, the judge said, I conclude that when the public protector contemplates taking remedial action against the subject of an investigation, that subject is entitled to an opportunity to make representations on envisaged remedial action. For a proper opportunity to be given, the public protector must sufficiently describe the remedial action in question to enable the affected person to make meaningful representations. Chairperson, please indulge me just to go through this because it's fairly important part of the judgment which applies to the discussions that you may want to consider. The High Court held that the public protector's remedial action had serious implications for the president, including being a suspect in a criminal charge that carries a punishment of up to 30 years imprisonment. The High Court concluded that a failure to afford the president a hearing before the decision on remedial action was taken was fatal to the validity of that remedial action. This conclusion, too, is beyond reproach. So the Constitutional Court had adopted and agreed to that particular point. In addition, the president has complained that the emails on which the public protector relied were not disclosed to him, and that he was denied the opportunity to make representations on those emails. In his supplementary affidavit, the president stated, furthermore, these emails were not raised in the notice and made an appearance in the without affording me an opportunity to address them before the public protector concluded her investigation. The mere fact what could be improperly obtained evidence has been used in the investigation is enough to vitiate the report. So, in answering affidavit, the public protector does not dispute that the emails were not disclosed and that the person was not afforded a hearing on them. She responded in these terms to the relevant allegations. It is telling that instead of denying the contents of the emails, the person complains about how I obtained the emails to which I refer. I received many documents from anonymous whistleblowers. These emails were provided to my office anonymously and in hard copies. It is for that reason that I have no metadata in respect thereof. However, even if I knew the identities of whistleblowers, I have an obligation to protect them. What the president has to do is to take this honorable court and the country at large into his confidence and explain the contents of these emails. I deny that I obtained the emails unlawfully. So court went on to say, while it may be true that the public protector had lawfully obtained these emails and was entitled to have regard to them during the investigation, she was under a legal duty to disclose them to the president and afford him the opportunity to counter them. If he was able to do so, or that he makes whatever representations he may have wished to make on the emails. It is a basic principle of our law that if a decision maker is in possession of information that is adverse to the person against whom a decision is imminent, that such information be disclosed to the person concerned and that he or she be given the opportunity to deal with that information. Our jurisprudence shows that a decision based on adverse information which was not disclosed to the affected person and in respect of which that person was not heard is fatally defective and ought to be set aside. Here, the public protector based the crucial findings on the emails, which were delivered by anonymous persons at her offices without disclosing them to the president and affording him the opportunity to make representations. Notably, the authenticity of those emails was not established. In relying on them, the circumstances of the case, the public protector violated the Audi principle and her findings based on the emails must be set aside. Chairperson, a very long-winded judgment, but I think very, very critical and crisp in really setting out the issues relating to fair procedure.
Mr. Ibrahim, if I can take you back up to earlier parts of the judgment, because you started off by looking at an interpretation of Section 7(9) yes. of the Public Protector Act, yes. giving an implicated person a hearing. And you looked at that in the context of the Constitution and, most importantly, the Bill of Rights. I want to draw your attention to Section 39(2) of the Constitution. Do you have a yes. Bill of Rights? You do, eh, Mr. Ibrahim?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I want to put the proposition to you is that that interpretation is not simply novel to the Public Protector Act, but is the way in which all legislation is to be interpreted if one has regard to Section 39(2) of the Constitution.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Maybe it essentially says when interpreting any yeah. legislation and when developing the common law, customary law, every court, tribunal, or forum must promote the spirit, purpose, and objects of the Bill of Rights.
Absolutely.
And that would apply equally to the Public Protector in the application of the Public Protectors Act.
Correct. Correct.
And I don't want to get into details of cases with you, but in the application of any procedural fairness, one in upholding the rule of law would look at the provisions of the Bill of Rights.
Necessarily so. Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Chairperson, a fairly important power of the public protector is that of compulsion. And it's important to set out this in very short detail. The public protector has wide powers of compulsion and may subpoena any person to give evidence under oath or produce any document or subject themselves to examination. Non-compliance with a subpoena without just cause is a criminal offense. The public protector also has a power of search and seizure, provided with an appropriate warrant has been issued by a competent court. These are weighty and invasive powers afforded the public protector and should be exercised with great care, even though these remain subject to the courts and the judicial process.
And Mr. Ibrahim, if we can just pause there for a moment, those powers find its home in the provisions of the Public Protector Act.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And it's actually the public protector that has the power to issue that subpoena.
Right.
She doesn't have to go through
the court.
A court to do that. And that's what makes that power an important power. Or it's a tool that's afforded the public protector's office to make sure that her work or the public protector's work is not impeded by having to rely on anybody else
correct.
To subpoena documentation or
that's,
people.
Yeah, that's correct. I agree with that, yes. Jefferson, just to touch on the issue of conflict of interest, no person may conduct or assist in an investigation in which he or she has any pecuniary interest or any other interest which might preclude him or her from performing his or her functions in a fair, unbiased, and proper manner, unless that person works in government, performs a public function, or is subject to the public protector's jurisdiction and has been requested by the public protector to assist with an investigation. I think that's also fairly trite and basic. The next point is perhaps a little bit more important and very, very useful, because it requires what is referred to in this case of Mail and Garden as an maintaining an open mind. And so it's an important requirement imposed on the public protector in dealing with all investigations. The public protector essentially must maintain an open mind. One feature that is universal and indispensable to an investigation of any kind, the investigation must have been conducted with an open and inquiring mind. Now, the court had occasion to describe this mind, and I quote as follows. He says, such a mind is one that is open to all possibilities and reflects upon whether the truth has been told. It is not one that is unduly suspicious, but it's also not one that is unduly believing. It asks whether the pieces that have been presented fit into place. If at first they do not, then it asks a question and seeks out information until they do. It is also not a state of mind that remains static. If the pieces remain out of place after further inquiry, then it might progress to being a suspicious mind. And if the pieces still do not fit, then it might progress to conviction that there is deceit. How it progresses will vary with the exigencies of the particular case. One question that might lead to another, and that question to yet another, and so it might go on. But whatever the state of mind that is finally reached, it must always start out as one that is open and inquiring. So it's an important quality that is established. Jefferson, move on even further and more important than just an open mind is the ethical standards that go with the requirements of the public protector's conduct. I did say earlier that was enormous power that is vested in the public protector. There's an enormous responsibility that is associated with this. And part of that is clearly in the executive, in the ethical standards. And so in the case of the public protector and versus the present dealing with the executive code, so I'll refer to it as the executive ethics code, The Constitutional Court said the following about the manner in which investigations must be conducted and reported and the reports produced. And it's important to actually set it out in the detail that it has. The public protector must not misconstrue the law. She is required to consider and or apply and must not change the wording of the legislative instruments that binds the subjects of the investigation. The public protector may not create standards against which those being investigated are measured. The public protector's constitutional investigation powers are limited to the state affairs and affairs of public administration. The public protector should not expand an investigation without lawful justification. There can be serious consequences for those who are investigated by and considered in the reports of the public protector. Accordingly, there is a duty to act fairly to such persons. And we've already touched on the question of fairness. Whenever an individual is implicated during the course of an investigation, the public protector is obliged to afford such a person an opportunity to respond to the implicating evidence. And the quotation carries on and ends up with this, which says, for a proper opportunity to be given, the public protector must sufficiently describe the remedial action in question to enable the affected person to make meaningful representations. And goes to the essence of the fairness chairperson. The public protector should only draw conclusions that are supported by evidence. The objective of investigation by the public protector is to discover the truth. Where the investigation yields disparate pieces of evidence which do not fit into place, the public protector must continue digging until the true picture emerges. Furthermore, the Constitution and relevant legislation require that a public protector must conduct proper investigations, rightly evaluate the evidence placed before her, and make findings which are supported by established facts. Fundamentally, Chairperson, the public protector must not only discover the truth, but inspire confidence that in each investigation the truth has been discovered. And this is fundamental in the way in the conduct of the public protector, is to inspire confidence in the public, the people who the public protector is required to serve. The public protector's task is not to investigate criminal offenses. Those must be taken up by the police service. And of course, that comes from the legislation itself. When deciding on remedial action, the public protector cannot direct an organ of state to do something that is outside of its own powers and cannot be vague directives. Chairperson, I want to move on to deal with the conduct of legislation, litigation, because this is quite critical. No member of the public protector's office is liable in respect of anything reflected in any report, finding, point of view, or recommendations made or expressed in good faith and submitted to Parliament, or made known in terms of the Public Protector Act or Constitution. However, this exclusion of liability does not extend to personal liability for legal costs. And so a critical part, a judgment that was issued by the Constitutional Court, the Constitutional Court had concluded that the Public Protector may be held personally liable for costs incurred during litigation if guilty of bad faith or gross negligence in conducting a litigation and discharging her constitutional obligations. And it's important to weigh the statement that the court made against the vast powers that the public is afforded. So the public protector should always act in good faith. Given the high constitutional status of this office, courts too should guard against unwarranted costs. Whilst courts have and can issue cost orders against the public protector, but they should do so very cautiously, because in a personal capacity and in work-related litigation may have a chilling and deleterious effect on the exercise of powers. So you want to be cautious. The courts are cautioning themselves in terms of how they exercise this particular order. When a public protector participates in litigation, the public protector is subject to heightened standards as a public official. It goes on by arguing that the public protector must be accountable, must not lead or obfuscate, must follow procedure, proper procedure, must produce a full record, must be candid and place a full and fair account of the facts. And very importantly, Chairperson, these standards flow from a public protector's status as a constitutional citizen. The Constitution directly obliges the public protector as an organ of state to assist and protect the courts to ensure the again, you have these words, the independence, impartiality, dignity, accessibility, and effectiveness of the courts. I want to touch on an aspect which is particularly important because it requires generally a higher standard than ordinary functionaries set out in the Constitution. Even outside litigation, the public protector is subject to higher standards than ordinary persons and ordinary administrators. Thus, in the discharge of all functions, the public protector is subject to a higher duty and higher standards than ordinary administrators, such that the failure to perform functions properly and effectively is therefore a matter of grave constitutional importance. This is because, as the court identified, the proper and effective performance of the functions of the public protector is of particular importance given the constitutional mandate and extraordinary powers that are vested in the office. When the public protector fails to discharge her mandate and duties, the strength of South Africa's constitutional democracy is inevitably compromised, and the public is left without the assistance of the constitutionally created guardian. It means that the vital constitutional check against abuses of power is lost. So it's a pretty important quotation which should weigh heavily in how the committee applies its mind. Chairperson, I want to touch on now a fairly extraordinary part of the law. No other constitutional citizen in the Constitution is granted the power or the authority to be protected against contempt. The public protector is virtually the only constitutional office. And in Section 9 of the Public Protector Act, in the offense of contempt of public protector is created, affording the public protector the protection against any person who may insult the public protector or the deputy public protector. In connection therewith, an investigation to do with and to do anything which, if the said investigation has been proceedings in a court of law and would have constituted contempt of court. So, again, enormous powers that is given to the public protector and including contempt, which is not afforded to other constitutional citizens of a high status. Chairperson, if I may proceed to the personnel in the office of the public protector, because that's important. And in order to perform functions, the public protector is assisted by deputy public protector, a chief administration officer, and staff, all of whom are subject to the directions and control. Now, this is stated in Section 3.1 of the Public Protector Act. And it's very important because in the Constitution, it's silent about whether the appointment of a deputy public protector. Now, essentially, what this act does is it's a fairly interesting piece of drafting because the public protector is in a position of almost like a minister compared to a director general. So the public protector appoints a chief accounting officer. But unlike a minister and DG, the DG is required to oblige and submit to the PFMA. In this particular instance, the law says something different. The Act says the chief administration and staff, all of whom are subject to a direction and control, fundamentally different to the other sections of public administration and in the instance of a minister. Ultimately, the public protector is accountable for the decisions taken, albeit that the public protector is not the accounting officer. The latter answers to the public protector in ways beyond that which a DG would account to a minister.
Mm-hmm. In fact, Mr. Ibrahim, if you look at the wording of Section 3.1b of the Act, it does three things. It says the person to be appointed as the chief administration officer must be suitably qualified and experienced. Such person is appointed by the public protector or seconded in terms of the secondment provision in the Act.
Yes.
And then the third thing is that person assists the public protector in the performance of all financial, administrative, and clerical functions pertaining to the office of the public protector.
Absolutely. So it's under direct control of the public protector. Very, very different from other parts of the public service. There's a further important point which is relates to the deputy public protector, which is not provided for in the constitution, but is created by the act that we just talked about. And is also appointed by the president on the recommendation of the National Assembly. So the deputy public protector has no independent functions and only exercises such powers as a public protector may delegate. So it's quite basic. So it depends really on what the public protector requires, and the public protector will only delegate those powers that the public protector feels the deputy should require. However, by operation of the law, deputy public protector performs the functions of the public protector whenever the latter is, for any reason, unable to perform the functions of his or her office. And that's fairly basic. It's a general rule in administration. If I may proceed on the issue, then there's a further point which I think is of critical importance for this committee. Under Section 3.9 of the Public Protector Act, it states that the public protector, after consulting with the Minister of Finance, determines the remuneration, allowances, and other employment benefits, as well as the terms of employment of the chief administration officer and all staff members. Again, a fundamental departure from the way in which public service works. No minister is allowed to prescribe the salaries. A public protector can do that for members of staff. So public protector is given really wide authority and power as such. Chairperson, I want to move on to the question of the removal of the public protector and what are the legal requirements. Firstly, the public protector may not be allowed to vacate office due to continued ill health or upon request if the National Assembly may only be allowed to vacate if the National Assembly accedes to this request. So the public protector may only be removed from office in accordance with Section 194. Now, the important thing is this, that the only basis on which this removal can take place is the ground of misconduct, incapacity, or incompetence. It's three basic terms, and I'll touch on this and focus it on import. Further a little later. The second part is that it must be on a finding to that effect by a committee of the National Assembly. So if a committee comes to that conclusion, that is a critical requirement. And adoption by the Assembly of a resolution calling for the person's removal from office. And further on, it say that the president may suspend a person from the office at any time after the start of the proceedings of a committee. It doesn't prescribe which committee, but it says a committee of the National Assembly for the removal of that person. So once the committee has been established, the Constitution gives that right to the president to suspend a public protector. The Constitution therefore provides as follows. The National Assembly is the effective decision maker under Section 194 of the Constitution. While the president is responsible for the act of removing the public protector from office, he may only do so if the National Assembly has called for the removal of the incumbent and must comply with the National Assembly's resolution if it does not decide that the public protector should, if it does decide that the public protector should be removed. The public protector may only be removed from office on one of three grounds: misconduct, incapacity, or incompetence. The Constitution does not define these grounds. There's a lower standard. This is a lower standard than what is imposed on the judiciary, as judges are removed only on gross misconduct, a material distinction between the removal of the protector and the member of the judiciary. Jefferson, I want to just identify for the purpose of this committee, there are three constitutional offices that are of importance. The first is a president, the second is judges, and the third is a public protector. So,
Mr. Hassan?
Yes.
Just pause there. I was guilty yesterday of keeping everybody for too long. And I'm also trying to control the traffic. And so I need to find a way to balance the two. We're just going to pause for 15 minutes and take a break and come back. And I'd like you to then start from there. Thank you, members. It's now just about 10 to back at 12:05. Just for tea break. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Welcome back. We resume where we left. Mr. Hansen, platform is yours.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, we're talking of removal. I thought it would be useful for this committee to compare three different constitutional citizens of a high status or nature. The one being the president, the second being a judge, and the third being the public protector. Let's compare what the constitution says about them in terms of removal. When it comes to the president, the constitution deals with it in section 89. To remove a president, it requires a serious violation of the constitution, and it requires serious misconduct. You'll notice that the word serious is repeated in both instances. When it comes to a judge, it's referred to in section 177. To remove a judge, you need gross incompetence, not incompetence, gross incompetence, or gross misconduct. It's much more severe. However, the removal of a public protector can be on one of three reasons. The first is misconduct, second is incapacity, and the third is incompetence. So not such a serious status as that of a judge or a president.
So Mr. Ibrahim, if putting it that way, then there's almost a hierarchy. You need a higher standard for a judge, a medium standard for a president, and a lower standard for a public protector.
I would put it slightly different. Yes, I think I would agree with that. It is that hierarchy, yes.
Because you're talking about, it's like misconduct. You're talking about misconduct, serious misconduct, and gross misconduct.
Correct.
Unless you're saying serious is higher than gross, but that's not the language the Constitution uses.
No. The Constitution uses the word for judge, gross incompetence and gross misconduct. For a president, it's a serious violation of the Constitution and serious misconduct. But for a public protector, it merely says misconduct, incapacity, or incompetence. And in my opinion, what I believe is that the public protector is set at a different standard to that of a judge and a president. My understanding of it is that when one compares these three offices, it is because of the status, that the elevated status that a public protector is put, which means that with the power comes an enormous set of responsibilities. And that responsibility means that a public protector is required to conduct him or herself in a manner that is of a nature that is beyond a question. So the Constitution does not define for the public protector what is misconduct, incapacity, or incompetence. Clearly, it's my argument is that it's at a lower standard than what is imposed on the judiciary, as judges are removable only by gross misconduct. A material distinction between the removal of a public protector and a member of the judiciary. Chairperson, I want to proceed further to a point which I think of importance, because we need to distinguish a particular individual's incumbency, which I think must be separated from the constitutional office itself. And the court had an opportunity to consider the difference between the incumbent and the office itself. And I cite to you the quote, which says, axiomatically, the public protector's office is more important than any incumbent, distinguishing between chairperson, the office, and the person. The impact of certain types of conduct that shake its operations at the foundation may outlive the terms of office of a number of incumbents. You may weaken the office, you weaken our constitutional democracy, its potency, its attractiveness to those it must serve, its effectiveness to deliver on constitutional mandate must be preserved for posterity. So it's very important to separate the incumbency from the office itself. And in fact, my argument would take it a step further. It's even important that you protect the office from the incumbent. So the incumbent could conduct him or herself in a manner that may bring disrepute to the office. And therefore, to protect the constitutional status of this office and the integrity of this office, you need to ensure that the conduct is of a nature that is beyond question and repute. Jefferson, I want to go on to the question of when exercising the discretion, the National Assembly adopted a set of rules for the removal of an officer or a holder of public office in state institutions supporting constitutional democracy. It's commonly referred to as the removal rules in 2019. And it defines incompetence and misconduct. It's important to set it out. Incompetence is defined to include demonstrated and sustained lack of knowledge and to carry out an ability to skill or perform his or her duties effectively and efficiently. So incompetence in a public service generally, Chairperson, really impacts on the two terms, knowledge or ability. Ability, alternatively, skill to perform. And that relates to incompetence. But misconduct is somewhat different. It is defined as the intentional or grossly negligent failure to meet the standard of behavior or conduct that is expected of a holder of an office. And that's the definition that is offered to us in the document provided by the National Assembly. Very usefully, Chairperson, the jurisprudence helps us. In the matter of the Speaker versus Public Protector, the Constitutional Court recently set out the following regarding Section 194, and it is worth noting. Constitutional officers who function to hold his whole office in power accountable must also be accountable themselves. So watching the watchers, guarding the guardians. So it requires a higher standard, a standard of conduct. And so the accountability of somebody who is holding other officers to account must be of a certain nature and beyond reproach. Removing an incumbent from the office of the public protector must occur in accordance with the removal rules. Proceeding with Section 194, inquiry, as this committee is, in terms of the amended removal rules, the committee will be able to ensure that the public protector's accountability, because of a legal representative, will not be able to give evidence on our behalf. And because the committee may ask the office bearer directly to respond to certain questions, even if she is or is not at that time giving evidence under oath, and is at liberty to cross-examine the office bearer and to request that the office bearer be directly respond to the questions posed. Jefferson, so it sets out the matter fairly clearly. I want to move on to the question of the definition of misconduct, because that's fairly important. The removal rules define the concept of misconduct with reference to gross negligence and intention. And that's quite important and useful. The removal rules provide also greater detail to guide members of the National Assembly, which is not only beneficial but imperative to ensure fairness and consistency in Section 194 proceedings. Now, in the case of the Speaker versus a public protector, the Constitution Court also had opportunity to note that the process of removing Chapter 9 office bearers are similar to those for removing the president of the republic. So they're referring to the process rather than the requirement of negligence or misconduct or as opposed to serious misconduct. The Constitutional Court had occasion to consider the latter process. And in that context, noted the following. The constitutional provisions for removing the head of state are tools for holding the president to account. The same applies to a public protector. It's in the instance of the president, it's done by way of a motion of no confidence, and that holds the president to account. Under the Constitution, only National Assembly may remove the president from office. The Constitution does not define the grounds of impeachment, including what constitutes serious misconduct, and has left the details of those definitions to the National Assembly. However, the Constitution's intent was not to leave the definitions up to the individual members, else there would have been divergent views on what amounts to serious misconduct. And so the important thing is that accordingly, there must be an institutional predetermination. So the National Assembly is required to decide beforehand a predetermination of what constitutes serious misconduct. And so that definition is set out very clearly. And in respect of misconduct as defined in the removal rules, it is concerned with the standard of behavior expected of the public protector. It should therefore be measured against the constitutional requirements, including the fit and proper standard that we talked about earlier. Now, the public protector must be found to have a degree of fault in a form of either intention or gross negligence. Intention is often referred to by the Latin term dolus, and the colleagues in this room who are more familiar with Latin will know the definitions of not only intention, but the Latin terms of dolus directus, dolus indirectus, and dolus eventualis. So the way in which intention is set out, whether it's direct, indirect, or something that eventually an individual foresees the possibility of a consequence eventualizing. Now, unlike intention, negligence is assessed objectively from the perspective of a reasonable person. So if a reasonable person in the public protector's position would A, foresee the reasonable possibility of conduct having particular consequence, and B, take reasonable steps to guard against those consequences, but the public protector failed to take such steps. This is what was argued in the Kruger case. The removal rules do not merely require negligence to be shown, but gross negligence. Generally, what connotes a particular attitude of state of mind characterized by an entire failure to give consideration to the consequences of one's action, in other words, an attitude of reckless disregard of such consequences. So if you move on to the concept of the definition of incompetence, incompetence in the removal rules are defined as in the following terms. It's concerned with the duties of the public protector. Should therefore be measured against the duties of investigation, reporting, determining remedial action, and management. Now, it's also concerned with both a lack of knowledge and the ability of skill. So the question of, as I said before, incompetence being knowledge or ability or skill to discharge the functions, and a proven lack of ability or skill may show a lack of knowledge. Now, due regard should also be had for the distinction between reasonable mistakes and more weighty errors, which in the context of the public protector may include changing the meaning of legal instruments she is required to apply and disregarding this undisputed evidence. So it's a question of how one interprets the question of reasonable mistakes and what is weighty errors in the context required. The important thing is that these must both be demonstrated and sustained. It must be proven or shown on reliable evidence and consists of repeated conduct, as they would say, a serial offender, repeated errors or mistakes, and not just a momentary lapse of judgment, but repeated. Must be measured against the public protector's duty to discharge functions effectively and efficiently. Now, here are two important terms which I think are important to set out. And the duties follow from, amongst other things, Section 195(1) and 237 of the Constitution. Now, Chairperson, let me just deal with the question of the requirement of effectiveness, because this is important. Effectiveness is really measured against the objectives. So public servants will look at how effective you are. And when they look at how effective you are, it is measured against what are your strategic objectives. Have you delivered or not? But efficiency is measured against the resources. So with the resources that you have you done what is required of you? So effectiveness and efficiency are two legs on which this argument stands. Now, in the Executive Ethics Code, the Constitutional Court alluded to a notion of incompetence in the context of the public protector's constitutional duties. Let me read to you what the Constitutional Court said. It said the public protector, like all of us, is fallible, and mistakes are to be expected in the course of the exercise of the powers. It's just normal. Judges make it, presidents make it, all constitutional officers make mistakes. But what is troubling in this matter, and this is the distinguishing factor, is a series, not the momentary lack, but a series of weighty errors, some of which defy characterization of an innocent mistake. For example, giving the phrase willfully misleading the meaning of inadvertently misleading for it to fit established facts. She disregarded uncontroverted evidence. The nature and the number of errors committed by the public protector here call into question her capacity to appreciate what the law requires of her when she investigates a complaint arising from the violation of the code. This is surprising because the public protector is by definition, and we talked about the requirements, a highly qualified and experienced lawyer. As required by law, she has no less than 10 years experience in the relevant field of law. Chairperson, the Supreme Court also had indicated that the senior public functionary's failure to appreciate the correct legal position may constitute legal incompetence sufficient to warrant removal from office. And this is in a Jeba case, because it's not just an ordinary lawyer, but a public official recognizing the Constitution and what is the impact of the correct legal position that may constitute incompetence. Chairperson, I just want to conclude really on the issues of removal. Removing the public protector from office is a very serious matter. Should not be undertaken lightly at all. And this is evident from, among other things, the significance of the role of the public protector plays in our constitutional democracy. And the fact that such a removal can only occur with, among other things, supporting vote of at least 2/3 of the National Assembly. In the process of discharging its functions, the committee should have due regard for, amongst other things, the chilling effect that its decision may have on the effective exercise of the public protector's powers by incumbents to that office. But not only that, but also to future generations. So how one decides should be considered very, very carefully. And so removing a public protector from office is not really a light matter. It's a fairly serious exercise. But engaging in the process in terms of Section 194 of the Constitution is also a critical means of ensuring accountability. It's how this National Assembly exercises its oversight and holds people to account. It's also part of the rule of law, and it's in a public interest for the process to be final. So what's important in this is that, as pointed out in in the matter of the Speaker and members of Parliament are insulated from the outside repercussions in discharging functions. They have substantial freedom of speech. They can say as they please, as well as immunity from civil and criminal liability, as well as arrest or imprisonment. Their powers must primarily be exercised to promote only people's interests and institutional objectives of the Assembly. Furthermore, where interests of the political parties are inconsistent with the Assembly's objectives, members must exercise the Assembly's power for achievement of the Assembly's objectives and cannot frustrate those objectives in order to avoid harm to their political party. But the punchline is important.
If I can just interrupt you, that is very much in line with the debate that ensued yesterday about this committee exercising these powers, qua committee, impartially, unbiased, and independently.
To add to that, Chairperson, the importance is that members of Parliament must subordinate their political interests, the party political interests, and the interests of their parties to the institutional objectives, the objectives of Parliament itself, of holding the public protector or even any other constitutional office bearer to account, and ultimately ensuring that the South African public is served as contemplated in Section 182 of the Constitution. So a particular individual should not be equated with the Office of the Public Protector. Section 194 of the Constitution is primarily concerned with protecting the office rather than the particular incumbent. So it's holding that office and recognizing the importance of this office and separating the question of the office from the person, as we said a little earlier. The public protector may only be removed from office on one or more of the grounds of misconduct, incapacity, or incompetence. The definitions of the rules must be applied accordingly. It is up to the committee, first instance, to determine whether the definitional requirements are met or not. And the committee will apply its mind, consider the facts, and come to the conclusions. Individual members of the committee may not determine their own definition for what constitutes incompetence or misconduct. Instead, they must adhere to the institutional predetermination that was agreed by the National Assembly. This institutional predetermination is actually quite important because it sets out what those concepts that were set out in the removal rules. Chairperson, I want to conclude now my presentation. I apologize for being such so long-winded, but in the conclusion, I want to set out what may appear to look like a checklist, and it may assist this committee in just applying its mind to defining really what are the issues that require attention. So, in summary, the Constitution and associated legislative framework, including jurisprudence, require the public protector to do the following, and this is how we have summarized the following. One, respect the supremacy of the Constitution and the rule of law. That's in the Constitution itself. Two, strengthen constitutional democracy. That's the opening of the chapter 9. Three, focus on ensuring the discharge of public functions that is accountable, responsive, and open. It's also a constitutional requirement. Four, respect the separation of powers and legitimate sphere of operation of each branch of government, and in so doing, respect the decision of the executive, legislature, and judiciary. Five, to be independent and impartial, and perform functions without fear, favor, or prejudice. Six, be dignified and effective. The term dignity appears in a number of different aspects, so does effectiveness. Be dedicated and conscientious, and that's clear from the judgment that we talked about. Discharge your functions diligently and without delay. Nine, exercise only those powers that are conferred by law. 10, not assume the powers or functions of any other public functionary or encroach on its dignity, on its integrity. 11, adhere to the high standard of professional ethics. 12, ensure the effective economic and effective use of resources. 13, ensure that services are provided fairly and without bias. 14, foster transparency. 15, be accessible. You'll remember we talked about accessibility, and part of accessibility was promoting the roadshows and engagement with the public and how that is done. 16, cultivate good human resource management and be capable of managing an office that comprises hundreds of personnel and numerous departments or units. 17, exercise appropriate and effective control over the deputy public protector and the staff of the public protector's office. 18, delegate powers to the deputy public protector to exercise. 19, be capable of undertaking and managing numerous investigations of understanding and applying the constitution and the laws that regulate the public administration and affairs of state. 20, maintain an office that is accessible to the members of the public. 21, discharge functions so as to ensure ethical and effective public administration generally. 22, monitor the performance of the executive, which includes investigating alleged maladministration, abuse of power, discourtesy, undue delay, improper or dishonest conduct, improper enrichment, and improper or unlawful prejudice. 23, work to ensure that the public administration carries out its tasks without corruption or prejudice. 24, be the last defense for the public against bureaucratic oppression, corruption, and malfeasance. In other words, to protect the public. 25, investigate complaints from members of the public in respect of state affairs or the public administration. Report on the conduct complained of and take appropriate remedial action. 26, to decline to investigate conduct that occurred more than 2 years prior to the complaint unless there are special circumstances that distinguish the complaint. 27, consider a range of options in addressing a complaint, including mediation or negotiation, advising the complainant regarding appropriate remedies, and reporting an offense to or a particular conduct to the appropriate authorities. 28, in determining appropriate remedial action, not order an organ of state to do something that is outside of its own powers. 29, make clear rather than vague determinations. 30, be objectively fit and proper to render the constitutional functions of the office. 31, be appropriately experienced in law, the administration of justice, public administration, and or the legislature. 32, be a person of stature and beyond reproach. 33, be suitably qualified. 34, be scrupulously honest and have absolute personal integrity. 35, disclose all material facts and evidence and behave with utmost good faith when litigating and dealing with the courts. 36, not exploit loopholes or show disregard for the law or mislead in any way or make charges without supporting evidence. 37, ensure that all statements of the law are accurate and not misconstrue the law. 38, be a good constitutional citizen. 39, be willing and capable of taking on sensitive investigations that might antagonize the powerful. 40, observe the requirements of procedural fairness and confidentiality during investigations and allow potentially affected persons a proper opportunity to make meaningful representations. 41, consider investigations with an open and an inquiring mind and follow wherever the evidence leads. 42, discover the truth and continue digging until the true picture emerges. 43, not extend investigations beyond the affairs of state into the affairs of private parties. 44, not expand an investigation without lawful justification. 45, be cognizant of the serious consequences that can flow from an investigation. 46, inspire confidence in the integrity and completeness of the investigations. And 47, account to the National Assembly. Chairperson, I've set out 49 requirements. And these are based on the Constitution, the legislation, and the rules, and the case law. But it's fairly weighty and fairly lengthy. And hopefully it's a useful checklist for this committee to apply its mind. But these principles also overlap considerably in both impact and meaning, and clearly set a very high bar for the watchdog created for purposes of oversight. So at first glance, it may seem almost impossible and impossible set of standards to meet these as a collective, and may well be so. What requires an assessment in any inquiry could may well not only be compliance with the foregoing, but the extent to which there exists a failure. So it's not so much just complying to it, but it's the extent of the failure that may exist. To comply with one or more of the foregoing, and the extent to which any public protector falls blatantly short of what is required, so much so that it constitutes misconduct, incompetence, or incapacity meriting removal. Chairperson, thank you very much. That's basically my submission, and hopefully it is of some value to this committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was a good marathon you ran there. Appreciate it. Advocate Sabawa?
I have no questions, save to add maybe one thing, Mr. Ibrahim. You touched on it earlier on in your address. And on the 47 principles that you put out there, there's another fundamental aspect on the public protector. It is that body which should be available to the poorest of the poor in a way. It touches on your accessibility, but it is the one recourse for the poorest of the poor in the country.
Absolutely. It's what I described as my superhero.
Because there are no cost implications for any person to approach the public protector.
Absolutely. I mean, accessibility accessibility in South Africa has been defined in a fairly interesting way. And we started that concept really from, I'm pleased to say, in the Constitutional Assembly, where we were not just open, but accessibility meant the office reached out to people so as to ensure that people could engage. So the services of the public protector must be available to the poorest of the poor. Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Advocate Bauer. Mr. Hassan, as I would have introduced, so in the room you have Hassan Ibrahim, sorry. Did I say Hassan?
Yeah, it's fine. I mean, I'm quite content with it.
Thank you for that. In the room you have members of the National Assembly who are members of this committee. And as I introduced at the beginning, on my left, I have the public protector legal team led by Advocate Mpofu. With Advocate Bauer having interacted with you throughout your presentation, I'm now going to take the opportunity and invite Advocate Mpofu. He might not have any issues to raise, but in case he has, I will invite him to interact with you. And just to indicate to members of parliament or of the committee, you custodians of this process. So they will come to you, but if at any point there's something you want to make sure is not missed, feel free to do that. You will indicate. It helps the flow of the interaction. Trust me that when it spoils it, I will be able to intervene. Thank you. I now recognize Advocate Mpofu.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Ibrahim.
How are you this afternoon?
Very good. Thank you very much, sir.
Good. I think let's just start with a warm-up, the basics. Am I right that you do not have a South African legal qualification?
Yes, in fact, I was qualified in Botswana. I went through the panel. In the early 90s, we had a panel to translate foreign qualification into South Africa. I passed through the panel. What I didn't do is apply to court for appointment as either an advocate or an attorney.
So I take that as a yes.
Yes.
Thank you. We need to just establish what you are an expert of, so that we know how you may be of assistance to the committee, correct? So what would you say that is? What are you an expert of?
Chairperson, I think it's a fairly difficult question. The point is that with my legal qualifications, my experience in the negotiations process of the Constitution and then implementation of the Constitution, I worked 10 years in the Department of Justice as a Deputy Director General, implementing the Constitution, including two of which as the appointed Chief Master of the High Court. And thereafter working for various ministers and serving the Chief Justice in the establishment of the Office of the Chief Justice, after which I served the United Nations in different offices in different parts of the world, but primarily on the area of constitution making and drafting of constitutions in different countries, where I assisted and supported in establishing what best practices were in constitutions and constitution making. I hope that provides you some basis.
Not really, but let's try and do it slowly. Or maybe more concretely. I don't know what you're saying, but the...
Would you like him to repeat that?
No. Chairperson, I don't know if you want me to... Please don't interrupt my question.
No. I'm not interrupting you, but I chair the session, and I have to facilitate the session.
Yeah, okay.
You have indicated that you did not know what he was saying, and I thought if that's the case, then he needs to repeat himself.
Then it means you don't know yourself the difference between hearing and knowing. I didn't say I didn't hear what he was saying. I said I do not know. Even if he repeats it 1,000 times, I will still not know it.
Then if we establish that, I will have a way to attend to that.
That's what I'm saying. Because I don't know, sir. I didn't say I didn't hear. I'm not there.
We'll have to follow a particular process. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. You understand that, Mr. Abraham? I'm not deaf. I heard every word you said, but I'm saying I don't know what you mean. You understand the difference? At least if you understand the difference, then I'm happy.
I'm happy you have a value judgment. You're entitled to that judgment and that opinion.
Okay. No, sir. I'm not saying, I'm not judging you. I'm saying to you, before I was interrupted, that I don't know what you mean in explaining what you are an expert of. Remember my question.
I would prefer not to refer to myself as an expert. I prefer to refer to myself from the experience that I have, and I've set that out for you. How you wish to treat that is entirely your judgment.
Right. Thank you.
I'm not going to argue with that.
No, thank you. No, I think that now I know what you mean. You mean you're not an expert.
You're entitled to refer to me as you please.
No, sir. I'm asking you, not what I'm entitled. Are you an expert or not?
Yes, I am. I'm an expert in constitution-making processes. I've worked at least 25 years in the processes of constitution-making in this country, as well as in many other countries and in helping many countries draft their constitutions, both in process as well as in content.
All right. Right. But you said you would prefer not to call yourself an expert.
Just a preference, yes.
Pardon?
It's a preference, yes.
Thank you. Okay, so do I. All right. Okay, maybe let's do it like this. You are not an expert in removal proceedings of public protectors or ombudspersons.
I think they're probably no experts in that area. It's a new area that is being discovered. I think it's an area that the courts are considering. It's an area that Parliament is applying its mind. I would find it very hard to find an expert in this particular field. People have, on the basis of jurisprudence and the legislation, applied their minds as I have applied my mind. I'm not sure, you know, what you're referring to.
Okay. I'll also take that long thing as a yes. Okay. You are not an expert in the removal of public protectors or ombudspersons, yes or no?
I have knowledge and I've looked at the legislation, the constitution and the jurisprudence, and I've given you my views on that.
Sir, okay, I'm asking for the last time. You are not an expert in the removal of public protectors or such offices as ombudspersons, yes or no?
I would prefer not to say that I'm an expert in that area.
So that's a no?
Yeah.
Or rather, I'd say yes. Yes, yeah. You are not an expert.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right. You are also not an expert in constitutional interpretation.
I've had a fair bit of experience in my work in different countries in terms of constitutional interpretation. I've worked with a number of different countries. I've written and contributed in a number of different books and so on. And that is in my resume. So I have contributed to it. So I regard myself to have significant knowledge in that area.
Yes. So I also have significant knowledge of that. I'm asking you a different question. You are not an expert in constitutional interpretation, yes or no, please?
I have views as a legal professional and as a person in my capacity. I've had an opportunity to consider. I prefer not to regard myself as an expert, yes.
Thank you. Okay. So that's the second thing you're not an expert on. Okay. Now, you have made some statements which are based effectively on what I will then call your view of the interpretation, since you are not an expert like everyone else in the street, your view of the constitution, some of which I'm going to deal with, but I just wanted to know at what level am I still with them, whether with an expert or just like a chit chat that we might have in the passage. All right. One of the things you have said is that a public protector can be compared to a judge. And by the way, I agree with you. But I just want us to unpack that statement. You know that something we discussed here yesterday, that
the Parliament, National Assembly, has a duty to protect the independence of the public protector.
Yes.
Pardon?
Yes. Yes.
If you nod, it won't
be. There's no question about that.
Yes.
It's a constitutional requirement.
Yes. And you know that part of the duty of the National Assembly is to assist, not only to protect, but to assist the Office of the Public Protector in asserting its effectiveness, dignity, and more importantly, its independence.
That's correct, yeah.
Correct. Right. Now, you also made a very important point about who watches the watchers, or as I prefer to coin it, who guards the guardians. Correct?
That's correct, yes.
That's also an important principle of accountability, correct?
Absolutely.
So, for example, that's why judges have to be accountable, because we rely on them to hold the rest of society accountable.
Okay.
Correct?
Yes.
And the same courtesy should therefore be extended to a process like this. In other words, these guardians here have to be guarded as well. Correct? Or let me put it simply, they must act lawfully.
Naturally, yes.
Yes. And you would agree that if the process, a process such as this, is tainted by illegality, then, to borrow from Mr. Hendricks's not-so-favorite expression, Honorable Hendricks, then it would be a futile exercise.
It would be a serious issue, yes.
It would be a futile exercise.
The process you're talking of?
Yeah, if it was tainted by illegality.
Illegality. I think that's something one should consider, that one think it through before I give you an answer on that.
But why do you not think such a simple thing through? If a process is tainted by illegality, yeah, it would be a futile exercise. It would be a nullity.
That's possible, yes.
What is the other possibility?
It's a question of what you're referring to in the process. If the process itself, I'm not here to look at this process itself. I was here to refer to provide a submission on my views on the legal context and framework. That was my brief, and that's what I came here to do. I did not come here to talk about the process of what is being undertaken here.
I thought when you were giving your 49 points, you said you were assisting this process.
I was assisting this committee.
Yes, the committee, yes, and the process is the same thing, sir.
If you wish to say so.
I say so.
Thank you.
So will you answer my question then? If the committee or the process or whatever you want to call it is tainted by illegality, do you agree that that would be a brutumfulment, a wasteful exercise signifying nothing?
I'm not sure I would go to that extent. I think that the illegality would impact on the outcome of the process, yes.
Sorry. I'm sorry. Right. So you don't agree then? Have you read the EFF versus National Assembly case, the second one, because I'm surprised you didn't refer to it.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes, what?
Yes, I have.
Which one?
The 2016 case, yes?
No, that's not the one I'm talking about.
The 2016 case?
No.
Okay.
Is that the only EFF versus National Assembly case you've ever had?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, there is another important EFF versus National Assembly case, which I agree with you. Obviously, you have not
read. 2018 case. Yes.
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 Yes, what?
Yeah, I've read it. The 2018 case.
Oh, I thought you said the only case you ever read was 2016.
Sorry, excuse me.
I thought you said the only EFF versus National Assembly case you read was 2016.
No, I conflated the two. The one is the 2016 case, and the second is the Economic Freedom Fighters versus the Speaker of the National Assembly.
Okay, no, that's fine. Yeah. We'll distinguish them. The 2016 case, we'll call it EFF Nkandla.
Yes.
The other one we'll call EFF Impeachment.
Okay.
Okay. And I gather now from your latest answer that you've read the EFF impeachment case.
Yeah.
Yes?
Yes.
And do you agree with what is said by the Constitutional Court in paragraph 289 that an exercise like this would be wasteful, or rather, at least challengeable and reviewable if it didn't comply with the Constitution. In other words, if it was tainted by illegality.
Yes. That's what the Constitution, the Constitutional Court.
I've just said, do you understand, Mr. Prem, that we're dealing with the EFF impeachment case?
Yeah.
Yes. If you want the full citation, it's 2018, volume 2, I think it's page 571, CC. Okay, the majority judgment of chapter J is what I'm referring
to. And you took us to a particular paragraph?
289. I'm just... okay, I've got it here, but not in full. Anyway, but it doesn't really matter because you agree with the sentiment.
Do I agree?
You agree with the sentiment that...
Let me get that paragraph in full, please.
Yeah. And you get what?
I just want to know that we'll get the full paragraph.
Yes, you'll get it.
That's what I'm just requesting through the chair. Thank you, sir.
Okay, just wait.
Mr. Melda, will the support staff can assist?
Just didn't want to waste your time. Normally, you come back to such things, but if there's an insistence, that's fine. We'll wait.
Asking this.
Oh, you mean, you want to get it now or at some stage?
I'm not asking Advocate Mpofu to read it to us. I'm asking the committee to be given a copy of that exact paragraph in full.
Oh, okay. No, you'll do that. I read it out to you yesterday, but I'll read it again today.
I'm sitting with the judge and that I'm not seeing a paragraph 289.
Yeah.
So I'm just double checking with you.
Okay. My juniors will look for that. It's the same one I read to you yesterday, Mr. Mulder. But I can do it today again.
I'm still requesting paragraph 289. Then.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Ibrahim, forget about the paragraph numbers. We'll get it now. You agree with me, or rather, with the sentiment expressed by the court that a an alleged removal process that doesn't comply with the law would be not an impeachment process, a valid impeachment process.
Yeah, I'd have to look at the. I don't actually have the judgment in front of me.
Forget the judgment. Well, I'm asking you about the sentiment. Do you agree with the sentiment that if there was a constitutional process that is tainted by illegality, it would be set aside, reviewable and set aside by a court of law?
Yeah, no, I'd actually appreciate having a look at the judgment to answer your question, really. You're asking me to give you a statement.
Just a pause. Apologies, Advocate Mbofu. Just a pause there. If you could please pause, because I am now going to ask that we adjourn for lunch, and then we resume with you immediately. In at 2 o'clock.
Okay, sure. But can I just put one thing? No problem. So that you can mull over it over lunch, Mr. Ibrahim. You realize that you're here to assist the committee.
Yes.
Not to assist any narrative.
Absolutely.
Okay. And therefore, your questions should be just forthcoming, because I'm not trying to track you. I'm just asking you questions so that you can assist the committee. Do you understand that?
Oh, absolutely. I'm not avoiding your question. Okay. I'm only asking to have reference to the point you are referring to so that I can answer to it.
No, you are avoiding my question. Let me explain why. And I want you to think about it at lunchtime. I said to you, forget about any judgment. Assume there's no such judgment. I'm asking you a very, very simple question. Do you agree or not with the sentiment that if there was a process like this and it was tainted by illegality, it would be a futile exercise? I mean, why do you need any judgment for that? I'm asking you that question.
You are basing your argument on what
you said. No, I'm not basing it on anything. I'm asking you a question, a simple question.
Just allow him to complete as well. Yeah. Go ahead, Mr. Hassan.
It's fine.
Jefferson, it depends on the nature of the defect that is being referred to. It will then impact on whether it is legal or not legal.
Okay, maybe after lunch we'll have a better answer.
We'll pause there and we'll resume at 2. Let's go for lunch, members and everybody else. Thank you.
Yeah, actually, I think we need the lunch break.
Okay. I see
Thank you.